Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we will be speaking with Roseanne Olson. She is a photographer and author of the book, This Is Who I Am, Our Beauty in All Shapes and Sizes. Right now, I would like to welcome Jungjin Lee. She is a photographer, and she will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. And this is an event of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, nice to meet you.
And Gabe Gomez is here, and he is the residency director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Yay. Good to have you back.
Good morning. Nice to be back.
So you are a photographer whose work is very unusual. You make limited editions of very large prints, and instead of making 100 or 50 or whatever, you make one or three. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell us how that works and how you evolved your work.
I'm making print on the handmade rice paper, coating with liquid light, which is a gelatin silver print. So as I'm coating paper by myself in the dark room, it shows the unique quality of the print. So it's very difficult to make many number of editions.
So liquid light is basically a liquid that you can buy that makes any substance that it can adhere to into essentially photographic paper.
That's right. But I've been working with the rice paper for 20 years. I still have a hard time dealing with this paper. So it takes very long time to understand the paper. And then the surface has to be right to coat this emulsion. Otherwise, it could peel off in the water.
Right.
Difficulties. Yeah.
And so, and of course, you have to do it in the dark. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. So you have to basically kind of do it blind.
That's right. Well, I coat the paper under the safety light, I'm quite good at now. I'm making very large print, like 80 inches by 60s, so which I cannot find in photographic paper. So
they don't even make photographic paper that large, do they?
No. I prefer making print on this handmade paper because of the quality of the rice paper. I thought the subjects that I deal with is mostly about the natures, which is very well suited with the paper. So it's not just the image is floating on the paper. The paper is kind of breathing. So the tone of the print came from the deep inside of the paper. So I think the paper is very good with the subject matters.
Let's talk more about the subject matter that you choose. Some of them are objects or things, but they're very abstract also in a certain way.
I've been making a few different series. Many of them are deal with the landscape, but thing series is about the objects. It's kind of a meditation objects that I choose. So even though I photograph the landscape or objects or body of my self-portrait, I always more obsessed by showing my introspective state and thoughts. So it looks similar to me.
And so you do landscapes, including, I mean, you're from Korea, but you do some landscapes in New Mexico.
Yes.
You were a resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
Yes. Well, New Mexico is one of my favorite states in the United States. I used to photograph a lot in the Southwest Desert in 90s. I photographed the desert scenery. Took me 6 years to make the series. And then I had chance to stay at the Santa Fe Art Institute last spring. And then I begin to photograph the landscape in a different way. That comes the Wind series.
And so it's called the Wind series. Why did you call it that?
Wind is the energy of free spirit that I understand. It's not strictly confined the physical movement of wind as we know. So the idea where it's about the energy, the banishment and transformation, whatever, sadness may change. It could be the meaning of the wind in my work.
Do you photograph people at all, or is it always landscapes and objects?
There's me.
There's you.
Yes.
We're talking to Jung Jin Lee, and she's lecturing tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute series at Tipton Hall at 6 o'clock. And there's actually going to be an exhibition of your work from August 2nd to August 22nd. People can mark it on their calendars far in advance. Have you ever photographed, have you ever used regular photographic paper, or is the rice paper just the only way you work?
Well, I do make a print on the regular photographic paper. It's just not the final print. Just
to test it.
To test, yeah. And then mostly I show work, the rice paper work.
And so you are from Korea. Did you learn, what was your education like there, and then what happened when you came here?
I learned paintings and ceramics, not photography. I just taught myself. And then I was working as a photojournalist in Korea. And then I came to the United States in 1988. I want to become an artist rather than a photojournalist. So I went to NYU, and I had a meeting with Robert Frank. So, there's a long story. I think we should start again.
We're talking to Jung Jin Lee. Where do you live now? You live in Korea?
Right now, yes.
And so, is there an art photography scene in where you live in Korea the way there is here?
Well, it's similar, but there's more variety in the United States. And well, these days, people don't separate what is photography, what is painting. I mean, many photographers take photographs as an artist. So they bring their idea of a thought in the photographs rather than just documentations. So I'm a part of the, so I don't see so much difference between Korean photography and American or European photography.
One thing that's interesting about that, viewing the work, and there's actually an exhibit right now at Bellas Artes of the Wind series
in Santa Fe.
Yes, in Santa Fe, that actually opens. It will open this. It opened last Friday, and one of the tremendous things that photography is really, I generally know a little bit about it, but the prints, the Wind series of Jung Jin's prints are just, they're tremendous. I mean, you could see they're very subtle. Something about the way they're put on into, I guess it's known as mulberry paper. It's not so much, it's this type of thing. And
like rice paper except made from mulberry plants.
If memory serves, I don't think there's like an actual such thing as like rice paper, but it's actually just mulberry paper. But it's so stunning the way the image is sort of is realized, and when you sort of take into account some of these ideas that Jingjing was just talking about, there's just such tremendous movement within them, and just the nuance and how the image just sort of just appears. And because there's such their large format, it's absolutely just stunning to see on the wall. So. It's just really wonderful. And also, just to mention, there will also be a DVD that Jingjing will be showing at the lecture. And this is it shows her doing the process. So it's kind of almost like a documentary of the work. So she'll lecture for about 40 minutes. And we'll view this video just so you can see how it's done. And like I said, Jingjing was saying, she's been working with this paper for over 20 years. And it's still kind of a work in progress, but it's a really sort of it's stunning to see, and so we're very very proud to welcome her back, certainly.
I remember working with liquid light back in photography classes many many years ago, and it's very difficult. It's very tricky business because there's so many different kinds of paper and so many different sensitivities of paper, and with liquid light you really have to learn about that emulsion in a way that's not easy. Gabe Gobez, let's talk for a moment about the residency program. We've had many of the residents here on KSFR, but we've never really talked about what the residency program is.
Yeah, well, it's many things, but it's a primary thing that we do at the Institute. And what it is we award over 60 residencies per year to artists. So what we do is that we provide resources, time, place, and support for artists to come to Santa Fe at the Institute for 1 to 3 months and allow them to do their work, either through, if they're writers or they're visual artists. And so this is the seventh year that we've been doing it in this particular building on the College of Santa Fe campus. And it's been really wonderful to see. I've been there a little over a year. I was actually a former resident in 2005.
So in poetry.
And it's really tremendous to see from this point of view. The artists come from all over the world into work, and I think it's really wonderful to see them sort of really become involved in the community and all that Santa Fe in this area has to offer.
I imagine some do more than others. Some are going to hole up in their studios,
exactly.
And some are going to go out into the great wide landscape.
Exactly. In a great way, and it leads into our monthly open studio, which is a really great way to see what they're up to. It's we open the doors once a month. And let the public see a little peek of the work in progress, which is my favorite thing about working there, because we let them do their thing, try to facilitate any of their needs as much as possible.
Now it's not only photography, painting, but also poetry translation.
Poetry translation. We have a wonderful co-sponsored residency with the Witter-Bynner Foundation. Poet translators. We award two poet translator residencies per year, we have choreographers and ceramic artists and painters, photographers, filmmakers, experimental video. You name it. I mean, it's artists from all over the place.
But no oil painters.
No oil painters.
It's a toxic thing.
It's a toxic thing, and it's a storage toxic thing. But it's interesting to say that we just hosted 9 of the artists that participated in the biennial. And one of the artists who was also from Seoul, from South Korea, Soon Hong, he worked specifically in oils. I mean, he's done this for pretty much his entire life. And for the 2 months that he was with us, he worked in acrylic, which is just—it was tremendous to see because he just. I mean,
how did he feel about that?
Yeah, at first I have a feeling they were with us, someone was with us for a week in January, and we sort of broke the news to him. He was like, oh man, what am I going to do? But it was, he just didn't miss a step, and he created just the most stunning work, the most stunning paintings.
That are at the biennial now.
Yep, exactly. And so it was just terrific. So,
Do you feel that, are you able to track what the residents do after they're here
Santa
Fe?
We keep a short leash on them. No,
really?
we try to keep in touch with them. We're building an alumni network. It's really for the artist, and I'm speaking from experience, you really build a bond for life with the people that you are in residence with. I mean, when you have, say like a poet or a playwright sharing the same space with a sculptor or someone that works just specifically in encaustic or whatever else, you have a real opportunity to exchange ideas. And our residents, they share meals together, they go out and do things together. So it's a real bond that they create. And so part of my responsibility is to really keep tabs of what they're doing. And it's just amazing to see that, like, some of the work, like, for instance, Zheng Jing, she created this in the Wind series. Now it's back here as well. And, when the artists get, shows from the work they've created at the Institute, it's just absolutely wonderful. And so we most definitely know what they're doing and what they're up to. And
do you feel like there's a lot of interdiscipline inspiration? In other words, the poets are inspiring the painters, and
I hope so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's the environment. The Institute itself is conducive to that, that sort of experimentation and that sort of innovation. So, like, just and really the art. I mean, when you're talking about you talk about the theoretical, and then you talk about the practical, the application of it, and I think that ultimately sort of just kind of melds together. And then plus with our lecture series, we have master artists, if you will, or professional established artists coming in and talking about their process. So it's just a whole thing. And plus with our education, we have young people that sort of chime in their two cents, and we have we just had an exhibit of their work called Sounds of Change. So all of these different things work simultaneously to create this thing, this really wonderful environment.
What's the longest and the shortest residencies you have there? I mean, are people there for 6 months or 1 week?
One to three months. Ideally, I'm encouraging more of the artists to stay longer. You're there for a month, and if you have, like, say, a specific project, but more often than not, we hear the artists, say, "Oh man, I wish I could stay 2 months. I should have wished I could have planned it." And it's reality. You take a 1 to 3 months off of work or your life. It can be tough and challenging, but if you can stretch it, man, we really encourage our artists to stay as long as possible and to really experience it and sort of grow. And it's really wonderful to see, especially, like I said, with the open studios, every month you see a different thing and you see their ideas evolving, and it's just terrific.
And very occasionally, not often, there is actually a Santa Fean who wants to get away from their own
absolutely
house or studio and go to the Santa Fe Art Institute. They're from elsewhere.
Absolutely. And if I could drop a name, Lori Polina, right, who was a local artist here, and a wonderful cellist, who sometimes played for us, he's a local, and I don't think I've ever seen an artist more prolific than Lori. He created, I think, over 30 pieces, which was just so great to see. But most definitely artists locally here that we can support.
And how does it work? Do they pay their own way, or their scholarships? Is it subsidized?
Well, it's a little bit of both. We try, as much as possible to meet the needs of the artists, and to truly support the artists, we have, we have residency fees, but we also have funds from foundations that can cover those fees, or we have scholarships. Essentially, we don't say no to anybody. We try to be as flexible and as accommodating to everyone to be there. And that's one thing I'm really proud of that we do, is that we provide that support that frankly a lot of arts organizations simply can't do, and that's one of the things that I think we do best. We just provide that unconditional support.
And there was a special set of residencies after 9/11, 2001, and another set after Hurricane Katrina.
Yes, and now actually, arriving tomorrow on Tuesday, we have a young artist who is a graduate student from Iowa, and the entire printmaking studio at the University of Iowa was flooded, and she is part of a group of graduate students that just took everything. I think it was from the basement or something, but they took all the prints and the archives, and she actually left to California with her parents, and now she's actually she will be with us for a month,
drying out the
drying out working
prints.
Yeah, exactly. And
good
so
heavens.
And so it's she's gonna be, well, she's a grad student, so she has to create work for a thesis, so we're supporting that. And so it's the emergency relief residency is what we call it. Is something that we're also very, very proud of that we can do. So and flexible enough that, if something like this comes along, then we could provide.
Now, is it a very competitive thing to get into? If you're an artist or a poet or a translator or whatever, are you competing against hundreds of people?
I got to tell you, I just completed, earlier this spring. We have two deadlines per year. And what happens is the artists apply, and then I just sort of put them all together for a committee. We have two committees, one for writers and of all genres, and then one for visual artists. And so both committees are made up of people who specialize. And although I can't say specifically the name, it just I call them the luminaries. I mean, just truly some people of that have earned every ounce of my respect. It's really tremendous artists and established critics, et cetera, et cetera.
Who are on this committee?
Who are also local as well.
Yeah.
And so what they do is they view the work and the slides, and or they read the work, and then as a committee they decide. So we're completely out of it. And so they award the residencies.
And do they, I mean, if 100 people apply, how many get in?
Well, actually, let's put it this way. This last application period, there were 100 and over 140 applications, and 39 artists and writers were let in. So that's both for, so it's
somewhat competitive.
It's fair. I would say it's very competitive. Yeah. I would be
more than some.
I would hate to be on the other end of that committee.
Right.
It's tough, but it's absolutely wonderful. And I got to tell you, we have some amazing people coming up that we're super excited about. We have actually, one of our Witter Binner poets, Stephen Tapscott, which I personally, because as a poet, Stephen wrote and edited what is perhaps the definitive collection of South American poetry. It's this wonderful anthology of 20th century Latin American poetry. And he's an MIT prof, and he's going to be with us for a month in November, and we're so psyched. It's just amazing.
Well, we hope to get him on the air to hear poetry in multiple languages.
Absolutely. And so, and like I said, I could go on and on. It's so exciting to see some of these folks come up. But like I said, every month, open studio, reading.
And we always announce it and often feature it on this program.
Absolutely. And we're very thankful for that.
Well, Gabe Gomez is the residency director at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And Jung Jin Lee, let us not forget, is going to be lecturing tonight about her work at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, right next to the Santa Fe Art Institute. For more information, you can go to sfai.org or call 424-5050. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you once again.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We will be right back. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Roseanne Olson. She's a photographer and author of the book, This Is Who I Am, Our Beauty in All Shapes and Sizes. And she will be at Garcia Street Books on Saturday, the 5th of July at 2 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, this is a book of photographic portraits of women, along with texts drawn from from interviews that you did and statements by these women. How did you start doing this project?
Well, I started this project about 6 years ago, probably, and the reason I started it is that I had a client who asked me to photograph her, and she wanted to lose weight first. It was for her professional use, and then she got diagnosed with a very aggressive breast cancer, and she came to me and asked me if I would do a nude of her. And I hadn't done many nudes at that time, and I just said, of course, I'll do whatever you want. She wanted to give it as a gift to her husband. And that started it. Really, after she left, I thought, oh, my gosh, it is too bad that, she, at first she felt like she had to lose weight before I photographed her. And then she just realized something different about herself. And I thought, I think a lot of women are very critical of themselves. And maybe if we started thinking a little bit more compassionately about ourselves, we would appreciate ourselves more. So that's what started it.
Did you find that in the process of photographing, women developed more, of your photographing them, women developed more compassion for themselves and their bodies?
With the women I worked with, some of them have emailed me in over the years to say that the process really had a profound effect on their lives. I think not only the act of being photographed with an appreciative eye from the photographer, but also the opportunity to think deeply about who they are and what their body means to them and what their journey has meant to them. And, to me, the essays are a very important, probably more important than the photography, but a very important part of the book.
When I was in college, there were a lot of feminist studies essays about the male gaze and the way male artists look at women in painting and photography and in the movies. And I've thought about that a lot when I was reading your book and looking at the photographs in it. And I was wondering, how would you characterize the difference between the male and the female gaze, if there is a difference?
I think there is a difference in most art and in most photography. Most nudes have been done by men, not all of them, but most. And a lot of times they're done with a fair amount of sexuality involved, and in some photography there's sort of an edgy fantasy to it, and I feel that that's not the case in all, of course, but I feel that the way I tried to approach the women was a more feminine and appreciative of, in a more neutral way, not sexualizing the pictures, unless that was something that somebody wanted, but more neutral and just admiring their beauty as individuals.
It's interesting because it's a different kind of beauty than the beauty that you have when it's a sexual or erotic fantasy.
Uh-huh.
And it's hard to put your finger on what that difference is, but it's very clear when you look through this book.
Right. My intention was to go deeply into the palpable heart of what it meant to be that particular woman. I really tried hard to interview and understand each person's personalities, each person's personality, and to try to go that direction when working with them to learn, what expressions physically reflected who they are in terms of their emotional or psychological makeup.
There are some surprises in the book that come out only in the text, like the very first picture, a beautiful young woman, early 20s, and it turns out when you read it that she suffers from cystic fibrosis, which is invisible, and then once you read the text, you kind of see the pain in her eyes, which you otherwise not be able to see or certainly not be able to interpret.
Yes, I do agree. I mean, I think so many of us carry around hidden stories, and for her, and her name is Emily, and she was 22 at the time, unless you look closely, all you see is a very beautiful girl, young woman, and then once you hear her story, you're right, you do, and you see some circles under her eyes that may be a giveaway to what she's going through physically. I mean, I think that's true for a number of people. There's one woman in the book who I photographed. Her name is Candace, and she's in her 50s. I started out photographing women first and then getting essays later, and I found that was just impossible because the photography was the easy part, and the essays are much more difficult. So I photographed her, and I just thought, well, she's a lovely, vivacious, beautiful woman, very athletic. And it took her 4 years to finally come up with her story. And she was unable to write about it, so I interviewed her in person. And what I learned is that she had been sexually abused as a child, and it was carried through her whole life in how she feels about herself. Well, when you go back and look at her picture, you can really see that in her body, in her posture, in the way she holds herself. So I think it's really interesting to see the person and then listen to the story.
Sexual abuse and rape and incest are themes that run throughout. It's certainly not everybody's story, but it's enough that you really start to get a sense of how women carry these pains in their bodies and in how they feel about themselves.
Yes, exactly. And I always had this theory that if we went to New York City and gathered 50 women off of a crowded street and put them on a bus and went on a trip so they didn't have to worry about taking care of anything for a little while. And if we interviewed all these women, we would find similar stories to what the stories are in the book. I think that everybody carries with them stories of overcoming illness or overcoming abuse or, you know, just dealing with difficulties throughout life. And that's one reason I did the book, is to help us see and connect with all the people out there who are similar, you know, in many ways to what we go through, what each woman goes through.
We're talking to Roseanne Olson. The book is called This Is Who I Am. The question of illness is also a theme running throughout the book. For some women, illness was kind of a hidden gift.
Right, because they had the opportunity to see themselves in a different way, to learn to appreciate life. In one case, a woman named Michelle had breast cancer. After her diagnosis, she lost 100 pounds and decided that she wasn't going to wait for life to just happen to her. So she quit her job, became an actress, moved to Los Angeles, and she is currently having a great time. It's a wonderful story.
It's a wonderful story indeed. And then there are also some stories of women. One was a gymnast and one was a dancer. And at very young ages, I mean, adolescence or even earlier, or young teenage years, their bodies started to fall apart and they lost their ability to do the thing that they most loved.
Right. Both of them had scoliosis. And they both went on to do other things, of course, but one of them in particular became a dancer anyway, but a different kind of a dancer. She didn't continue to be a gymnast. She became a Irish jig kind of dancer, you know, a dancer who didn't need to have the flexibility of the gymnast.
I was wondering about that because it said in the text that she became a dancer. And I thought, when you've got a steel rod holding up your back, what kind of dancing can you do? Of course,
yes,
it's Anglo-Irish.
Yeah, exactly. And talk about working around your adversities. I mean, that's just a perfect example of doing that.
So one thing that I did notice is there really doesn't seem to be very much consistency about how much or little the women accept their bodies, really, at any age.
I know. I think that's true. And when I went about doing the book, I didn't go about it with any point of view, and I didn't look for anybody who had resolved or their issues or people who had actually come up with answers. The book is just mainly a way of meeting other people in a rather different way, you know, people who are undressed and very revealing of their interiors in a certain aspect of their lives, because I thought that there really are no answers, and I thought that just each woman might be an opportunity for a reader to connect with that particular person. And it seems to be what's happening. People seem to see the book as sort of a multifaceted mirror. So you look at it and you find somebody you can connect with. And then you go, oh, wow, there's somebody else like me there. Or there's somebody that I'd like to be like. Or this is the same experience that Susie's going through. I've gotten a zillion emails from women who have told me that it's really affected them because they've found somebody that they connect with.
It's interesting because you also, as a woman looking at it, you sort of wonder what you would go through if you were asked the questions. I mean, you asked the women a specific set of questions, mm-hmm. in the that led to the essays. Mm-hmm. You know, do you love your body? What would you like to change about it? How has it let you down? Have you supported it? And so on. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do it, but one finds himself wondering what your own answers would be, because you don't necessarily know. Did you go through this process yourself?
I have. Over the last 5 years, it's been an incredible process for me to think about these things and I absolutely have thought about them, and I feel like I'm changed because of it. I think I've become much more appreciative of myself. And that I feel good about aging, getting older. And part of that comes from thinking about some of the questions and being the women in the book. But I just wanted to tell you about a couple of emails that I've gotten, how the book, that describe how the book has affected some of the readers. One of the emails I got was from a woman who told me that she had a friend come over who wanted to see the book. And she showed her the book, and she was paging through it, and she stopped at the woman who was sexually abused. Now, apparently these two women had known each other for 30 years, and so after her friend read this essay, she closed the book, and she said, you know, there's something I've never told you, and that is that I was sexually abused when I was a kid. And it somehow opened her up to be able to talk about it, which I think is a great thing.
That's quite amazing.
Yeah.
It's funny, what gives you permission to say things that you've never said before? And sometimes it's the image or the story of a complete stranger.
Yeah, and just finding that, you know, there's somebody else who dared to reveal that, and okay, so maybe it's okay to do that. I got another email from a 17-year-old student from San Francisco who said that she always hated her body. She's a size 12, and she always wanted to be a size 2 because, you know, that's what we promote in our society. Anyway, she said she had been depressed for about 5 years and tried to commit suicide because of her size. And when she read the book, she felt that it really changed her way of thinking about herself, and that she could finally appreciate her imperfections and appreciate her body. And I'll tell you, if the book can help people that way, that is just my highest goal.
I have to say, when I was reading it, it was so striking, and it's not like we don't know this, but it was so striking to see how much time people spend, how women spend, particularly thinking about their bodies, more time than they need to in order to be happy, in order to be healthy. And if you took all that time and energy and converted it into, you know, solving political problems, the world would be totally transformed overnight.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? That would be so fantastic. But then look at how much time our culture puts into advertising, and how much money into advertising using a certain standard that we've created of certain thin-looking, almost anorexic-looking women that these high school students compare themselves to. And so they spend so much time trying to achieve that look when, you know, it's really so unnecessary.
High school students, heck, women in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and forward are still...
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Anorexia is another issue that comes up, and I guess that's something that you write about yourself from your own life?
Yes. I did experience that when I was in high school and in college. I was a gymnast, and I was very, you know, like lots of gymnasts are really focused on weight and control. So I was telling somebody this story the other day about going on a date with my boyfriend in college, and we would go to the Dairy Queen, and he would have a sundae, and I would just sit there and not eat anything. And it wasn't until years later that I felt like I could eat ice cream and really enjoy it, savor it, and not feel as if the world was going to fall apart if I had a taste of ice cream. So I can definitely appreciate that approach to the body.
There's such an interesting balance that you strike in this book, because when I heard about what the book was, but before I saw it, I thought, wow, I bet these pictures are going to be ugly, because they're not you know, they're outside of the sort of, you know, beautiful media aesthetic. And there is something which is both beautiful and real in these photographs, which I haven't quite seen before in this same way. You know, were you conscious of that while you were doing it?
Well, I think the key is that I really felt that I connected with each person I photographed, so there was a high level of trust during the photo shoot. And the other thing is that in my connection with them, I was able to see each one of them as beautiful in one way or another. And there is something beautiful about everybody, I think, if we take time to get to know them. And so really it wasn't difficult at all to make pictures that were relatively nice, lovely-looking women. I think that women could be photographed to look, anybody could be photographed to look beautiful or not beautiful, but the goal of my book is to help us see ourselves in a light of beauty and accepting of diversity.
Did you find that there were cultural differences in the way that women saw themselves in their own bodies?
Oh, yeah, I do. I really do. I found that among the, and I've heard this from other African-American friends, but among the African-American women in the book, I found that a lot of them said that their families were never gave them a hard time if they were heavy. And one woman said that her aunts and uncles used to encourage her to put more meat on her bones. So there was that more, I would say there was greater acceptance among the women I photographed who were African American in their families, their parents, of loving them and not criticizing them. For the Asian women, especially those who had moved over here from Asia, I found that the culture over there is even more stringent than our culture and even more narrow in its definition of feminine beauty. And so they actually found the American culture to be a little more forgiving. So I thought that was interesting.
There's a kind of interesting irony that I've noticed just in walking around in the world, but one sees it in this book as well, and that is there are a lot of women who just hate, especially when they're young, being seen as sex objects, and then at some point in their lives kind of buy into the propaganda and really start going in more in that direction. And it's like it's like you're living with a weird cognitive dissonance when you both try for something and you can't stand that people are seeing you that way.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's very, very complicated what we've created in our culture. And there's also a sort of a disconnect between, you know, what we say is okay. Like we decry, we would never have like a nude on a billboard where they're very comfortable with that in parts of Europe, for example.
Right.
However, we have primetime television runway shows with Victoria's Secret that are extremely sexy and revealing. So there's this sort of odd disconnect with all of that going on in our culture.
We're talking to Roseanne Olson. You also, in your work as a photographer, photograph dancers and musicians. Did your work in those domains inform how you did this project?
Oh boy, that's a great question. I think that in my work in general, I try to connect in a meaningful way with whomever I work with, and I always try to learn a little bit about somebody's story before I photograph them, even though it may not be exactly relevant to the photograph. It definitely helps to connect. It makes it more relaxing and more fun, and more, you get more of the real person. So there is that connection.
Are you planning on doing more of these types of portraits? I would think that there's there would be a demand for them.
Oh, you know, I would love to, and I would love to do another book because I think it could go on and on. But I'll just have to see what unfolds since this sort of just recently came out. I'm enjoying the newness of it.
We're talking to Roseanne Olson, and the book is called This Is Who I Am, Our Beauty in All Shapes and Sizes. And Roseanne will be here at Garcia Street Books on Saturday, the 5th of July at 2 in the afternoon. Have you been to Santa Fe before?
Yes, I have been there many times. I've taken classes at the Santa Fe workshop and then the photo workshops there, and then I've taught there several times as well. And so I really love Santa Fe.
Well, we look forward to seeing you here. Once again, the book is called This Is Who I Am, Our Beauty in All Shapes and Sizes. And we will see you at Garcia Street Books at 2 o'clock on Saturday.
Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing everybody.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Adios.